Here we go.
We're on.
Here we go. So, I really enjoyed the book, and one of the questions that I had while I was reading had to do with the way in which one of the authors that I work, you know, Cavell, actually thinks of the link between tragedy and skepticism, working especially on Shakespeare. So, I mean, it's a different kind of tragedy from a certain point of view, but my first question is, since in your book you mostly focus on ancient tragedy, if you had something to add about Shakespeare, and if you see differences, or if there is something that tragedy in Shakespeare can also teach us about skepticism and philosophy.
You bet. So in 2013, I wrote a book was published with Jameson Webster called, here it was called The Hamlet Doctrine. In the States it was called Stay Illusion. And that's a study of Shakespeare's Hamlet, which in many ways is the other arm of this project. So this book began as a book on ancient tragedy. It was more on the modern conceptions of the tragic. Then I began to go back into the dramas more and more and more, and then began to form an idea. And then I was teaching a class with Judith Butler in 2011, and things began to open up interestingly. And then Jameson and I had this idea, we could do this reading of Hamlet. We could take all this material and do it as almost like a line by line. We tried to quote every word of Shakespeare's Hamlet in the book. We didn't, because it's a very long play, but we quoted a lot. So yes, Shakespeare is always on my mind, and very much on my mind. The correlations are complex. Obviously, Shakespeare's knowledge of the ancients is a moot point, and it certainly comes through Seneca, who's a more important figure than the Greeks. I'm independently kind of interested in Seneca. That's a separate set of issues. But Shakespeare's all over the background of this. And Cavell, I probably don't mention Cavell in the book, probably not. But Cavell's on my mind, always on my mind. And what I remember from reading the Claim of Reason, you know, a long time ago, and thinking about Cavell in the 90s, was, you know, what is the tragedy is about the, in many ways, the acceptance, the attempt to accept the limitations on knowledge claims, right? And where knowledge has to be limited, then there can be a space for acknowledgement, and then in a parallel way, that means the epistemological question of skepticism concerning other minds is not just a dead philosophical question. It also has a kind of life. So there is a life to skepticism as a philosophical question, and then Cavell develops that as a reading of Shakespeare, and I very much take that to heart. So Cavell is kind of is on my mind, and then there are other. So Cavell would be, you know, in terms of Cavell would be one of the few thinkers from within the Anglo-American tradition with whom I feel a real proximity in terms of what he's up to, his intent, and also the fact that he's interested in things like Shakespearean tragedy, philosophy, but he's also really interested in movies and interested in jazz and popular music, and all those things are part of the continuity of Cavell's space. Yeah. I think that's kind of exemplary for the way in which a philosopher should function.
I could really see that in the book, but it was it struck me that the name was not explicitly mentioned.
No,
but I saw him in many of the things that you were thinking in this book, and I guess that my second question is linked to this and has to do with the way in which you focus on the fact in your reading of Oedipus King,
mm-hmm.
you claim that the tragedy shows that we collude with fate in yeah. our misfortune, and you say that in a certain sense Oedipus already knows an awful
mm-hmm.
lot,
mm-hmm.
He paid more attention to mm-hmm. the details. He should have also he could have avoided
mm-hmm.
to kill his father. And I wanted to ask you something about this relationship between lack of knowledge and lack of attention. What's
mm-hmm.
so it strikes me as a kind of new reading of Oedipus King, away from the standard reading that we have.
Yeah.
And what does it tell us also about the task of philosophy away from just the problem of knowledge and towards problems of attention and attention to detail? How
yeah.
does this
it gives
relate
us
to
it
philosophy?
Leaves us in a much more complex and perilous situation. So the standard reading of Oedipus the King, which in a way we goes all the way back to Aristotle, is that Oedipus goes from ignorance to knowledge. Oedipus didn't know, and then he knows. So his tragedy is a tragedy of knowledge. So the moral of Oedipus is that, when we get to know things, we get to know who we are, and some bad things might happen, but basically we can put things right. It's a lovely reading, but it doesn't really match what's going on in the play. At the very end of Oedipus the King, he's still raging. He knows, he's blind, his eyes are out, and he's still... his last words in the play are words directed to Creon, which are something like, whatever happens... He says, my sons are... My children, who are also my brothers and sisters... My children, well, the boys will be okay, they're boys and they'll fight or whatever, but my girls, let my girls stay with me. These poor girls, no one's going to marry them. Antigone is meaning, look at them, what a mess. Let them stay with me. And Creon says, yeah, you are not master here anymore. Do not think you can still play the master. Oedipus doesn't learn in the play. And then before the play begins... He knows the truth of who he is from the oracle, and he doesn't know who his father is. The oracle says, you will kill your father, and you'll be a parasite, and you'll commit incest. And the nature of the identity of his father is unclear. What's he do? What he does, he walks along the road, going back, not clear where he's going to. He can't really go back to Corinth, so maybe you should go to this new place, Thebes, and see what's up there. But along that road, he meets an older man, not knowing who his father is. And this older man, who Jocasta says in the play when he asks, well, what did this Laius look like? She says, actually, he looked a lot like you, except older. And he meets this older man. They have a road rage dispute on the road, and he kills his guards and he kills the older man. You might have thought that having been told the truth about who he is by the oracle, he might exercise caution about killing an older man, right? But he doesn't. He goes ahead. Now, what interests me at that point is that when Oedipus, in his rage, and it's rage which is interesting, in his rage, he both knows and doesn't know. He knows something about who he is, and he doesn't know who he is. And this... And the really deeper... perilous implication of this is that who are we? Well, we're creatures who both know and don't know. It's not a question of knowledge or ignorance, but both at the same time. And this comes out, and if people say, well, that's nonsense, you think, well, I just say, well, what's your relationship to your family like? What happens when you meet your mother, right? You're going to meet, let's say you're going back for a birthday or it's Christmas or whatever your religious holiday is, and you've got some beef with your mother because she's your mother, but you're going back, you're on the train, you're driving back, whatever it might be, and you think, I'm not going to lose it, it's going to be fine, we're going to get 2 days, I'll be in, I'll be out, it's all going to be peaceful. And then after an hour, you find that you're lashing out, and she's lashing out at you. At that point, in that rage, when we lose it, knowledge is kind of acting through us. It's kind of moving through us, unknowingly. And that's something that philosophy has a very hard time dealing with. Psychoanalysis has a much better structure for thinking about that, because a symptom in Freud has that structure. A symptom is something we both know and we don't know, right? Or a neurosis is like that. You know this rash on your arm has got something to do with your anxiety about your trip to Warwick, and yet you don't know that. So this where this leaves us is in a much more complex and more realistic understanding of our relationship, the relation between knowledge and ignorance.
Whew. Okay, there's one final, or further rather, issue I'd like to raise with you, Simon.
Okay.
And we can conclude with this topic, which is that in the book, because I think it's an important aspect of what you're doing with tragedy, actually, and showing why, on your terms, it's important for philosophy, you obviously display, I think, in the book, an impatience, I think is the right word, with any Schopenhauerian-inspired indulgence in tragedy.
Right.
Whether it's in terms of either a belief in the futility of life or the expression of some moral resignation to a fixed and immutable human condition.
Right.
So what you want to do instead is say, no, tragedy's important and takes us outside of that Schopenhauerian domain completely.
Mm-hmm.
I very much sympathise with that move, because it affords us the experience of what you call a deepened sense of the soul.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could say something about that and how for you that deepened sense of the self is linked to what you see as tragedy exposing us to the importance of our vulnerability.
Yeah. So that deepened sense of the self is the deepened sense of the self as deepened by our vulnerability. So that's the image, the picture of the self that emerges in these plays for me is a self which is porous, open, and bleeding, like Oedipus bleeding from his eyes. It's like that. We're selves which we're not. Desiccated individuals separated in our private Idahos or our private filter bubbles, we're leaking into each other all the time, and so we need a kind of a better account for thinking about that leakage. And it just happens that tragedy is one, Shakespeare be another. Where does Lear begin and Cordelia end? Where does Cordelia end and Lear begin? They leak into each other, and that's what gives us the drama. Mm. So these, and again, that's an insight which is very familiar to us. It makes in terms of stories and literature or the way our lives are lived. But in philosophy, we want to engage in some kind of intellectual hygiene and tidy things up. And also the fact that, with going to Schopenhauer, there's nothing resigned about, there's nothing pessimistic about tragedy. If there's pessimism, it's a really cheerful one. It's a more Nietzschean pessimism. I think, you can read Schopenhauer for the jokes.
Yeah. But would you agree that maybe Schopenhauer's problem is that he's a metaphysician?
Yeah. That's his problem.
As well as having that tragic sense of life, it's informed by the metaphysics.
Mm-hmm. And then it's always...
So it's very different to Nietzsche, conceptual tragedy.
Yeah, except, what I said about, porous leakages is also true of philosophers. Schopenhauer's relation to Kant, or Nietzsche's relation to Schopenhauer, or your relationship to whoever, my relationship to whoever, that often when we're meant to think of ourselves as individual authors writing papers and books and in our own offices, but we are often formed as kind of couples, you know, interior couples. Nietzsche's a great example of that. Nietzsche is in this constant war with Schopenhauer, which is one of complete dependence, right? And having been a Schopenhauerian. And the same thing with Wagner. You know, what makes the tension with Wagner interesting is that Nietzsche was a Wagnerian, and he gets it, and he's trying to resist it.
Yeah.
But he's resisting something that he is. And then you've got drama, interest, internal division, and that's...
I think you could almost read Nietzsche's intellectual biography in tragic terms, because
when
he writes about human all to human, where he has this profound break with his former incarnation as a Schopenhauerian and Wagnerian, he says human all to human is a monument to a crisis.
Yeah.
It's a kind of traumatic experience he's been through, an intellectual crisis, which would have its effects in other ways. But then in Dawn, I think it's aphorism 481, he has this wonderful aphorism. chapter and verse. He has this wonderful aphorism where he says he values those thinkers in whom he finds a passionate history of the soul marked by crises and catastrophes. And he says, he speaks of Pascal, Rousseau and Goethe, and Spinoza and Plato. Yeah. And he says what he doesn't like is Kant, because he says Kant's philosophy is of the head, and it's a life of rigidity.
Right.
And he doesn't like Schopenhauer, though he says he does display an interesting vehement ugliness, because it's the expression of a character, an intelligible character.
Yeah.
Let's conclude on that. About that aphorism.
This is what makes, when people get interested in philosophy or do philosophy, they somehow think they're going to get out of this in one piece, or it's all going to be, it's going to have a happy ending. I mean, to be an interesting philosopher, to do that work, requires a kind of internal catastrophe and a kind of thinking and a working with that with honesty. It's really hard to do, and we have very few examples, but I say Nietzsche for me, which is why in a way I kind of keep him out of the book, because he's too present. Because Nietzsche for me, I mean, Keith's written about Nietzsche for, you know, decades, and I've always I'm Nietzschean, but I've always found the work too difficult and unstable to really work on, right? So it affects me too much, and there's so much internal dissonance between different periods of Nietzsche's work. So being a Nietzsche scholar is a very hard thing to be, and so I'm not. But he's everywhere here, and the honesty of Nietzsche for me, you know, is exemplified in his relationship to tragedy, that Nietzsche writes the artist metaphysics of tragedy, the Schopenhauerian view of tragedy, in The Birth of Tragedy, 1872. And then in 1886, when he's a little bit older and wiser, attacks himself in the 1886 preface in the most extraordinary terms. He turns on himself with absolutely relentless honesty, and then again in Ecce Homo. And that... So Nietzsche is decoupled and coupled at the same time. So, it's not that you're wanting to invite people to, you know, catastrophe, but, you know, there's a sense in which with thinkers like Nietzsche, the stakes are really high, and you've got to, you know, respect that.
On that note, we're going to draw our discussion to a conclusion, and Daniela and myself would very much like to thank Simon for his time today, and we wish him very well.
Thank you very much.